First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-7, Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, Clinical Pathophysiology, presenter R.M. Feldman, Poliomyelitis in Rochester, Minnesota, 1935 to 55, Epidemiology and Long-Term Sequelae, presenter Mary B. Codd.
We get started. Our next speaker is Dr. Feldman from the University of Alberta Hospitals, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. He's going to talk to us on the late effects of polio and the clinical pathophysiology. Dr. Feldman.
Thank you very much. I'd like to first thank Dave for suggesting that I be invited to this conference. It's certainly been a delight to hear all the papers that have been produced so far. Each one of us, in our own way, tries to find some means of being more comfortable at the podium. The previous speaker walked back and forth, and I put up a window scene, which makes me feel right at home. And no, it's fine. Makes me feel right at home, and perhaps reduces the tension level a bit. I don't know. Certainly helps my personal thermostat. Over the past 5 years, an increasing number of individuals have been seen in a clinical setting with changes in muscle function related to the fact that they were among those who were afflicted with polio during the large epidemics of the 50s and 60s. These changes in muscle function are characterized mainly by weakness and fatigue, which have developed about 25 or 30 years after the initial onset of polio and have involved mainly the muscles that have previously been weakened during the initial onset, but which had recovered sufficiently to provide the individual with appropriate function in activities of daily living and work-related activities. The great majority of individuals give a history of having witnessed this general decline in muscle function, which usually began about 5 years prior to being seen, and which resulted in severe dysfunction requiring need of an increase in the use of ambulation aids and frequently a change from bipedal ambulation to the use of a wheelchair. These people appear to have the awareness of their body sufficient to clearly identify the muscle groups that have become weaker, and have the ability to describe what has happened to their musculoskeletal system in a way which is much more exact than members of the average population. Their history indicates clearly the degree of dysfunction that took place immediately after the initial onset of polio, and equally clearly the recovery pattern that occurred and more recent decline patterns in this system. Characteristically, the description is one of initial weakness, either of a paraplegic or quadriplegic or sometimes hemiplegic type, with a more rare incidence of localized muscle weakness, followed by improvement in function of some of the muscles which had become weak during the initial onset. This is followed after a period of 25 to 30 years by a decline in function of many, if not all, of the muscles that had improved in function following the initial onset and weakness. It is this most recent decline that results in severe dysfunction involving many aspects of activities which these individuals had been able to do prior without difficulty. Attempts at getting medical help for this most recent decline has most frequently been met by the idea that after 20 years of good function, there is probably nothing which can be done to improve these patients. And with this idea presented to them repeatedly, they have accepted the decline and the accompanying dysfunction and need for more intensive use of ambulation aids, other help, or wheelchairs. In this study, these patients have been evaluated by electrophysiological studies, and consistent changes have been noted in EMG as well as on repetitive stimulation studies. With the increasing number of patients demonstrating very similar electrical activity in these muscles that have recently experienced a decline in function, the electrophysiological studies have been able to help in identifying the groups of muscles that are amenable to strengthening exercises in physiotherapy. This very specific approach towards physiotherapy combined with teaching methods to improve function by occupational therapy and modification of bracing and more appropriate orthotic management, taking advantage of the most recent advances in this latter area, have resulted in an improvement in function and a reversal of the pattern which has been developing over a period of at least 5 years. This multidisciplinary approach towards the management of the late effects of polio has been attempted on an outpatient as well as an inpatient hospital basis. This choice is dependent primarily on the severity of the decline and secondly, on whether the patient lived close to the multidisciplinary facility, relating this to whether the patient would tire easily as a result of the need for transportation to and from the outpatient facility. we're in a situation in Alberta in which we're able to decide purely on clinical grounds whether a patient should be admitted to hospital. And this, I think, gives us an advantage in this type of circumstance because we don't have to be concerned about the possible financial repercussions of, say, a 4 or 5 or 6 week hospital stay. The University of Alberta Hospitals in Edmonton, Alberta, was one of the hospitals which received a very large number of patients soon after their onset of poliomyelitis during the large epidemics. The acute care as well as follow-up care of these patients was undertaken by the hospital, and good records have been kept regarding follow-up of these patients. Most recently, there has been an emphasis on the respiratory changes, and they'd actually been followed quite frequently by the respiratory service. And when they began to start complaining about musculoskeletal changes as well, it was decided by both groups, respiratory and ours, to set in motion what we needed to have a seminar on these patients. And 70 patients came to a seminar in which we discussed the various aspects of management of late poliomyelitis. In this, we discussed the respiratory aspects, the musculoskeletal aspects, the treatment of scoliosis by orthopedic surgeons. And after our preliminary report to them on what appeared to be a trend developing with individuals in their group regarding the development of muscle weakness and fatigue, a large number of patients came forth indicating that they had also noted changes in muscle function as we had described in a seminar. At that point, arrangements were made for these individuals to be evaluated clinically as well as with electrophysiological studies. And the first 12 patients, which we worked on at the beginning in this group, formed the basis for this initial report. On their first visit, the patients presented a history which indicated repeatedly that they had, in fact, had poliomyelitis during the epidemics, identified severe weakness, witnessed improvement in function, and now again were developing further weakness. These recurring complaints of weakness of muscles, together with a decrease in function and ambulation and self-care, and generalized fatigue, which was physical in nature, but certainly the emotional aspect of not knowing what was going to happen to them, contributed a lot, we felt, to this general fatigue. With the appearance of these changes in muscle function, patients were then subjected to electrophysiological studies. And these included motor nerve conduction velocity studies of the nerves leading to the muscles that had been identified clinically as being weakened, EMG studies of normal as well as weakened muscles, and repetitive stimulation studies of the neuromuscular junctions of normal functioning nerves and muscles, as well as those that had been identified in the group where recent weakness had taken place. Once evaluated, these patients were divided into two groups, as mentioned before, outpatients and inpatients, and out of the 12 patients which we studied initially, and this is an ongoing study, 6 were admitted into hospital as inpatients, 6 were seen as outpatients, of which 1 required only a change in bracing without any other changes. When they were seen in physiotherapy and occupational therapy, they were evaluated from the point of view of muscle function and ambulation and transferability, and also evaluated on a functional mobility scale which we had developed in the department for other neuromuscular disabilities. It was then decided as to whether or not they were going to come into hospital or whether they were going to be treated as outpatients. In both areas, whether inpatient or outpatient, we had a treatment protocol set up which mainly consisted of strengthening exercises of affected muscle groups, and we continuously cautioned both patient and therapist on the possibility of fatigue and the debilitating effects of fatigue. And this led us to the concept that we really had to prolong the length of time the treatment was going to take place, and that at all times this treatment had to be done under strict supervision. The patients who were really severely involved, we brought into hospital, were given the opportunity of resting between periods of exercise, and we were treating them twice a day in the physiotherapy department, so that we never really achieved a state of fatigue with them, and yet, as will be seen later, we were able to find over time that there was a gradual strengthening that took place in these muscles. In addition to which, if there was a generalized weakness that had taken place, either because of disuse, if a patient had been put into a wheelchair and remained in that way, and we thought that perhaps there was a possibility of ambulation starting up again, we would give them a generalized exercise program ultimately, when possible, leading to ambulation training. And in occupational therapy, we took advantage of any muscle groups that had been strengthened to provide OT and more efficient use of muscles. And then the orthotic management continued as well. And changes in braces was a rather interesting part of the whole thing. We found many of the patients had been brought into hospital with the same braces that were prescribed initially. Maybe they'd had one change, but they still had what we commonly called the clunky metal and leather braces, which really were very difficult to manage. Not only were we able to reduce the weight of the braces by giving them polypropylene braces and in the KAFO using metal knee joints, but quite frequently, as they progressed in physiotherapy and were able to reduce the need for bracing, we could transform a previous KAFO requirement now to an AFO, an ankle-foot orthosis, polypropylene in type, which fit into the shoe, which was much lighter, and therefore, again, increased the activity, the ability and the efficiency of walking in many of these patients. I've lost my place a little bit here. The results of what we attempted to do are in the next few slides, and I'll start with some generalities as far as what we found on EMG, as well as general results, and then I'd like to present three case reports. On initial evaluation of these patients, whose ages range from 33 to 74, we were able to identify the reason for deterioration in muscle function, with obvious weakness demonstrated in muscle strength anywhere from 2 over 5 to grade 4 over 5. Electrophysiological changes in these muscles demonstrated absence or virtual absence of insertional activity. And this at first made us feel, well, all right, we've got a lot of fibrosis in these muscles, and that's why the insertional activity is reduced. Surprisingly, when we attempted to keep the needle exactly in the same position and these patients were asked to move the muscle, we found normal appearing motor unit potentials on voluntary movement, but it was a marked reduction down as low as 20 to 25% of normal interference pattern in these patients in the muscles that had no or virtually no insertional activity. Only rarely did we find evidence of polyphasic potentials, and only rarely did we find evidence of fasciculations. On electrical stimulation, we found a distortion which was demonstrated, usually a decrement in neuromuscular transmission as low as minus 25. Occasionally, we saw increments of plus 10, up to plus 10. And on a few occasions, we found a decrement followed after a few moments by an increment in the same muscle. And this intrigued us, and again, we really couldn't determine why this was, but I think we might have had a clue as to what we were looking at when we heard Dave Weekers talking about a similar situation yesterday. Generally speaking, with this type of very directed type of physiotherapy program and the support from the other areas, we were able to get an increase in strength of muscle groups by up to 1 to 2 grades on muscle testing. The muscle testing was done by myself, and we managed to see these patients at least three, sometimes four times during the course of treatment, so that we were able to identify with the same examiner examining the patient the changes that took place in muscle testing. I should also add that when the therapists saw these patients, they frequently reevaluated as well, and there was pretty good correspondence between my results and the results obtained by physiotherapy. We also were able to demonstrate improvement in method and efficiency of function, and improved ambulation with reduced wheelchair need, longer distance walking, better use of braces, and decreased need for ambulation aids. And the examples that I'll be giving you will demonstrate this. I put in the last part of this slide on more efficient respiratory function to set us up for one of the patients that I'll be reviewing with you, who was requiring oxygen full time and was in a wheelchair and couldn't get out of the wheelchair when I first met her. And you'll see what happened as a result of this type of treatment as an inpatient when she finished her program. The cases I'd like to present to you now are three in number. Two were treated as outpatients, and one was treated as an inpatient. Mrs. J.L., who had polio in 1954, resulting in quadriplegia, with good return of function of all four limbs. And about a year prior to the time we saw her, she began to notice that she was falling rather frequently, getting an increased amount of fatigue, bilateral lower extremity weakness, inability to come to a standing from a sitting position, which really bothered her more than anything else, the fact that she couldn't come up to a standing position. And as I said, this had been gradually going on for about a year. She was a housewife, very active person, and there weren't any things in her immediate past that could have caused any deterioration in the emotional state or stress any more than had been present before. On initial evaluations on December the 7th, and that should be 1983, obviously, these are the results that we found on a directed examination of the musculoskeletal system. And as we progressed her on an outpatient physiotherapy program, she ended up with increase in strength. And you can see here, there was really a period from December right into the middle of April, 1984, a prolonged period of time where she was getting daily physiotherapy. She lived close to the hospital, so the transportation in wasn't really a problem. We frequently asked her whether she was fatigued by this, and she was not. There was a period of time when she was having a little bit of difficulty between February and March, but then continued at a lesser level of physiotherapy, but still maintained the exercise program that she'd been on, and ended up with excellent results as a result of the physiotherapy that was prescribed. Now, the effect of this was that she was now able to get out of a chair, which certainly made her feel a lot better about being able to still be the person that was responsible in her home. I'm sorry, the exercise program was mainly progressive resistive exercises.
And what regimen was that?
The regimen was based on the patient's own fatigue or trying to get to the point where they would gradually increase the number of repetitions against a particular predetermined weight. And after 20 repetitions at that same weight, we would then increase the weight and start with 5 repetitions leading up to 20 again, and then increase the weight again.
Did they do that once a day or once an hour during the day?
They did it for a period of about an hour with rest periods in between, so a total treatment time of about an hour, and this was done twice a day. Exercises against the weights as I've described. And we would do one of the muscles, and there would be a rest period, and they would do it again, and we predetermined for each patient how much progressive resistive exercise would be done. The patient's feeling of fatigue. If we got to the point of fatigue, we felt we had done too much, and we'd reduce. And from that point on, we were governed by the patient's ability to do it, just tolerance of the exercise itself. So that for each patient, the exercise program was different. But it was based on a patient's ability to be able to do the exercise without becoming fatigued, with periods of rest during the treatment time and periods of rest between morning and afternoon sessions.
Dr. Feldman, is there some reason you didn't measure the hip extension?
In this particular patient, hip extensions were normal. What I'm putting on the slides is only the abnormal findings as far as muscle testing was concerned. The other advantage that she gained by having improved this way is obvious, and that is that she stopped falling. And this, of course, for her was very important as well.
Do you have an idea of what caused the weakness in this patient?
I think it's caused by what we've been talking about for the last day and a half.
Because of the improvement, that's why I'm interested.
Well, this is why I'm presenting it, because we did find this kind of improvement, and I will end up asking a question. And the question is this, and I might as well ask it now so we can think about it. Is a method of physiotherapy or strengthening exercises over a protracted period of time, making sure that no fatigue takes place, the way in which we can improve function on these patients?
This was a long autoimmune type of weakness that this patient developed, and
yes.
Was it unrelated? You studied this with the EMGs
Yeah. All of these patients were studied with EMGs as I described. And what we did is particularly concentrate on the patients, on the muscles that had electrophysiological changes.
Dr. Feldman, your EMGs that you recorded were essentially normal.
They were normal except for absent insertional activity and a decrease in interference pattern of 20 to 25% of normal. And the No, there wasn't. There were no positive waves, no fibrillation potentials, rare polyphasics, rare fasciculations.
Okay.
I beg your pardon? Well, the...
If I could just interrupt as a prerogative here, let's go ahead and finish the rest of the case presentations and then come back for question and answer if we could.
Thank you. The second patient is a man who had polio a long time ago, in 1931. It affected his entire right side and his left leg. He had good recovery of the left leg and of the right arm. He had a 7-year history prior to being seen of increasing fatigue. Weakness over the entire left leg developed, and he had knee instability and was given a brace in 1978. He had frequent falls, a decrease in walking distance. He developed right upper limb weakness and right shoulder and left knee pain. The abnormal findings on muscle testing were described as noted when I saw him on August 24, 1983. In the upper extremity, they ranged between 3 and 4. In the lower extremity, there was a knee extensor at 2, hip abductors 3, knee flexors 3, and the others were 4. He progressed again as an outpatient from August 24th, 83, all along to April 1984. Again, he was fortunate to living close to the hospital, so transportation wasn't a problem. And he started off on a daily basis in physiotherapy, and in March started 3 times weekly attendances. And the results are as I've identified them on muscle testing as he saw him at relatively regular intervals. Now, once again, in this situation, as he developed, he had a KAFO on the had a KAFO in his left leg, and we were able to reduce that to an AFO and change the type of bracing that he was having as well. His falls became much less apparent as he went along, and by the time he was done, he really wasn't falling anymore. And the third thing was that the pain that he described, which was quite severe in his left knee, in his right knee rather, and his left shoulder, became non-existent as the muscles became stronger. And what I presume was that he was able to have better support of the underlying joint, and as a result of this, did not fall. Did not have any further pain. And the last patient is the one which is really, to my mind, the most interesting. I describe her as a case of the disappearing whistle. She arrived in consultation in the office, could not get out of her chair, and this had been going on, gradually increasing as a result of weakness for about 2 years. She had polio in 1950, resulting in paraplegia, returned the function of both lower limbs, and was carrying on a normal existence until 7 years ago when she noted progressive lower limb weakness. This increased, particularly in the left leg. It reduced her ability to stand and time of standing, and she became wheelchair bound 2 years ago, and also developed severe abdominal muscle weakness. Despite all of this, her main complaint when she came into the hospital, when she came into my office, was that she said, "I can't whistle tunes anymore, and this is really bothering me." The rest of her life had been settled around the disability that she had, and her husband was looking after her, but she was really upset that that amount of music had left her life. She was the one who required supplemental oxygen and carried an oxygen tank on the back of her, on the back of her wheelchair. When she was seen in October 1983, these are the results of muscle testing. Her ambulation was totally wheelchair. She had no other means of ambulation other than with that. We brought her into the hospital in October and kept her there until mid-November. And in that period of time, went through the program as I've described, with gradually increasing the amount of strengthening that we could do in the muscles that were selected based on electrophysiological studies. The results, and I think the ones that are really the most important, first of all, she was able to transfer out of her chair and come to a standing position. Secondly, by the time she was discharged, she was able to walk 50 feet without the use of oxygen, and so the therapist would follow her with the oxygen on a little cart, and she would take a puff or two and then could do another 50 feet. With oxygen, her amount of walking increased to 250 feet distance nonstop. Now, this resulted in a phone call from her husband to me saying, now what am I going to do? I have nothing to do in the house. She's beginning to do everything. And she then came over to us and said, I would like to work in physiotherapy. And she became a volunteer in the physiotherapy department. And oh yes, her abdominals increased just by one grade, but she whistled again. And this to her was very important.
Dr. Feldman, do you have blood gas medicine?
The respirology service did do blood gases on her. I don't have the results available, however. The results, I feel, of this study permit us to identify more exactly some of the changes that take place in muscle groups of individuals who have previously been afflicted by poliomyelitis and who have recovered, with particular emphasis on secondary leg changes. These changes are manifested clinically by weakness, resulting ultimately in decrease in function in areas which these muscle groups are required, together with generalized fatigue. A possible explanation for pain that is frequently experienced by these patients is offered, with the lack of support of underlying joints resulting from weakness, muscle weakness, as being suggested as one possible cause of pain. The electrophysiological studies demonstrate changes which are really quite specific, or appear to be specific, for this clinical entity, and really are quite unlike anything that I had seen in EMG studies on other patients. The use of a specific, goal-oriented, multidisciplinary approach involving inpatient or outpatient physiotherapy, occupational therapy, and orthotics permits us to improve the strength of the muscle groups that have become weakened and thereby improve function of these patients. In addition, the improvement of muscle function permits us to take a critical look at previous orthotic management and to make appropriate changes to reduce energy consumption in ambulation and therefore ambulation tolerance. The changes that take place in the muscles as a result of this approach are presently unknown, will certainly require additional closer study. The multidisciplinary approach, however, permits us to identify muscles that need treatment, permits patients to benefit from a specific and logical effort at improvement of function with reduction in energy consumption in performing these functions. I think also the opportunity of being able to get these patients into the hospital for an extended length of time, as I've already described, certainly prolongs the opportunity of helping them and reduces the fatigue factor with proper supervision to the point where we feel something good can be done for them. Thank you very much.
As moderator of this session, I would like to start off with a few questions. I guess we are, many of us who are not getting these kinds of results are obviously amazed, especially on this patient who went all the way from a 3-plus muscle to a 5. And I guess the first question that I have is, do you feel that this grade of 3-plus that was given to this one muscle who subsequently developed normal strength was a situation where that patient really had pain inhibition weakness and not actual true muscle weakness? And I guess that result, I guess what I'm leading up to is, did you personally do all of the grading, or was the grading done by a therapist?
I did all of the grading myself.
And how much of the grading, or how much do you feel that pain figured in with this weakness?
When there was pain, I tried to place the joint in a position such that where the contraction of the muscle took place, there wouldn't be pain, and use that as a method of identifying the muscle strength.
So you don't feel that pain in any way biased the muscle grading?
No.
Very good. Number two, and I think what everyone is very interested in, is maybe we ought to have you put it up here on the board, is exactly what was the exercise protocol and exactly what you were doing.
Okay.
Five repetitions against a particular weight without fatigue. use that as a starting point. And as we could increase, again, depending on the patient's tolerance of the different time, we'd increase the number of repetitions to 20.
Let me just hold this for you while you're talking.
Again, we would start at a particular weight which the patient could do to the point where five repetitions could be started, could be done against a particular weight without fatigue. And gradually over time, we would increase the number of repetitions to 20, a total of 20 repetitions. This would be done once, a total of 20. There'd be a period of rest of a few minutes, and then again, a period of 20, a number of 20 repetitions against the same weight would again be done. The frequency with which, or the number of times that this was done in a treatment session, again, depended totally on a patient's tolerance. So the patient felt that after, say, twice having done 20 repetitions against, say, 5 pounds, she was tired, that was it, we would stop. If, on the other hand, she could go 5 or 6 times, each time 20 repetitions, we would go the 5 or 6 times. Okay. Just. Well, if we started off at less than any gravity, it was a matter of maintaining range of motion and using manually rather than weights attempts to get the strength to an anti-gravity strength, at which point we can start weights. So we started at whatever level we could to start increasing the strengthening of that muscle. Okay. Once we got to 20 repetitions comfortably, we would then increase the weight that the patient was moving against and again start at 5 repetitions and move up from there. The level at which we stopped was the level at which the patient could no longer tolerate the exercise program. And this didn't mean pain, fatigue, and inability to do anything for 2 days. It meant, I'm tired, I really have worked as much as I can. And what I have to emphasize, I think, is that the motivation of these individuals to improve, the motivation that they had to get better strength in these muscles, having been told that it may take as long as 6 or whatever number of weeks it takes to get to a point where they can function better, their motivation was such that they were prepared to go along and work with us in trying to determine these fatigue levels and not overdo it to the point where we would have to perhaps cancel an exercise session in an afternoon. So there was excellent cooperation with preliminary discussion with the patients between myself and the patients and the therapist and the patients so that the program that was decided upon was truly a goal-oriented program and one that they agreed to go along with, and having done this, we were able to then carry it through. So basically, that was the program as we designed it for each individual patient. As the muscles became stronger, we then introduced occupational therapy depending on the dysfunction that the patient had experienced prior to the onset of the program. And we emphasized then at trying to improve function once the muscles became strong enough so that function was appropriate. Similarly, a similar approach was taken in the orthotic management in that once, for example, if a quadriceps became a 3 or 3 plus quadriceps and the patient had a KAFO, we then attempted to disconnect the top part of the brace and see whether or not knee stability could be obtained. And if so, we then ordered an AFO, polypropylene, and would discontinue the use of the upper part of the brace. So it was all based on observation and the patient's reaction to the program, and the progress of the program was completely dependent upon the patient's reaction.
One other question. I know that here at Warm Springs they have had some success with strengthening when they brought the patient in the hospital and put them at complete rest and basically done nothing but rest and exercise, and I wonder if I could get Dr. Bailey to comment on that.
We really have done essentially the same thing as Dr. Feldman. I know 2 patients I even had put on a program of a written gradually strengthening program. Others we've just let do a little more as they could. I was just wondering how you worked your program in with the self-care. Were you able to put them really at complete rest and prevent other activity during the day? We have some trouble controlling that part of it.
I guess it's really a matter of the kind of agreement that you make with that patient, and that was taught to me years ago when I was in residency. if you're going to work with a patient and you want to have the cooperation, you sort of strike up an agreement and you say, this is what's going to happen. You either take it or you don't. Now go home and think about it. And when you've decided that you want the program, let us know and we'll get started. And so, that's what we did.
So you had there was good adherence.
There was good adherence.
I think it will be interesting to see what the follow-up is on many of these people once they go back to a normal lifestyle, if indeed they can maintain that strength or whether it's lost.
Johnson, Columbus, to satisfy everybody, we've all done this, I'm sure, with old polio. This is not what we're talking about, PMAA, so it's obviously not an EMG or anything else. This may be something that only Dr. Knapp, maybe Dr. Perry knows about. It's called, Sister Kenny described it, mental alienation. In other words, the loss of muscle function, whether it be neurophysiologic mechanisms or proximal to that, but it isn't PMAA. And so a regular and the usual program of rehab works just like anything else. But do not confuse it with Dr. Dalakis's program. It isn't the same disease.
Richard Owen from Minneapolis. I'd hate to telegraph my talk tomorrow, and I'm starting to wonder if we might have a different breed of old polio in the northern tier states. We haven't seen the PMMA or the Johnson disease Dalakis disease, to the extent that must be prevalent in these poor benighted southern areas. The question I have, does this PRE system have a name? I always thought PRE was a name that Delorme sort of had patented. So I use some loose term called modified PREs. We use exactly the same process unless the person's coming in, and then I do the awesome thing of using isokinetic exercises, which I'm sure I'll find out is terribly dangerous to PMA people. The other thing I was wondering, did you notice the rapid increase in strength that would fit somewhat the point that Ernie made of alienation? Because Delorme, Mueller, and Dr. Knapp all pointed out this unusual quick increase of strength, which I think is a motor learning procedure, even in muscles that are great at anti-gravity. And it has to do with Mueller's idea that muscle sinks to the least level of function that it's required to do. And therefore, some major muscle groups actually start to fail. And that's what's created the confusion, I think, in the name of the variety of names that are falling on this batch of conditions.
I didn't see any rapid improvement, but one thing that does happen, and I've seen this time and time again in individuals, not only from post-polio, but others, that they will try to take over with muscles that they can function better with. And I think that results in a certain element of disuse as far as being able to use these muscles, and so they become weaker. And changing the pattern of movement to a more appropriate pattern will start that muscle going again for them, and it does need strengthening at that point. How much of this is that phenomenon, and how much of it is the phenomenon we're discussing today is difficult to know, except that I made every attempt to treat specifically with these exercises patients who had identified, as I mentioned, the secondary deterioration and those that had EMG changes, as I described as well.
Well, that statement brings to the next question is, were there some post-polios whom you did not treat because of inappropriate or not supporting EMG findings?
Every one of them that I've seen so far, and we're now up to number 17, have had the same type of thing. It's almost like dividing the muscle groups muscles they have into three groups. Those that are normal, those are obviously abnormal and not functioning, and then that intermediate group that I'm talking about that I've subjected to physiotherapy. Now, the one patient who only required bracing still had EMG changes, but still function was such that with a change in bracing, no other physiotherapy was required.
And so no physiotherapy.
Because there's nothing to strengthen, or you didn't need to strengthen it?
Once the bracing was done, there was enough function there that he did not really want to participate in the program.
That was Dr. Perry. I'll see if we can get a comment from Dr. Knapp.
Well, I've been astonished that the only thing we're talking about is strength, muscle strength. There are two other factors that I run into all the time in patients that come in with troubles. One of them is limited motion, mild, very, very mild contractures which interfere with function. You can have a functioning muscle which, with a joint that is really moving, that is very weak but very functional, and that same weak muscle will not be efficient if there's the slightest amount of contracture. That's one factor. The other is what we call coordination. And by that, we don't mean cerebellar, but we mean a functioning muscle which functions smoothly and often is very useful, even though its strength grade may be even a 2. And so there's quite a different attitude, at least on the re-education part. And nobody has mentioned anything but strength, which is only one factor. I remember, can I give an anecdote? When Sister Kenny was early at Minneapolis, there were a lot of doctors who came around, most of whom were very antagonistic. And we had a group of some 8 doctors, all orthopedists, from various places in the country up, and a patient came in who we had never seen and Sister Kenny had never seen. It was an acute polio. And she went in and examined the patient, and then she came out and had 2 of the orthopedists examine him, examine her, and I think one of them was Key's associate from St. Louis, I've forgotten his name now, McCarroll. And when he had examined the patient had a quadriceps which didn't move the leg and against gravity at all, she asked him if this was a paralyzed leg, and he said yes. She says, "It is not paralyzed." She was very diplomatic, as usual. And so she worked with the patient for about 5 minutes, and the patient held the knee extended against gravity. And the factor was not denervation, obviously. So the other factors come in. This is what she called mental alienation.
Sister Kenny was obviously praying all the while she examined the patient. We are going to have to obviously stop at this point because we're overextending ourselves, and possibly we'll have some time before lunch to bring this back up because obviously we have many questions in this area.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on Side 2.